everyone. I'm Gary Nall, and I'd like to welcome you to the Progressive Commentary Hour. Once a week, out of 15 hours of live broadcasting, we dedicate a program to the serious issues that are not being adequately or honestly or objectively reviewed by the mainstream and sometimes even the alternative media. Today, the topic is democratizing our economy from the ground up and building community to do so, strengthening local, sustainable economies that allow people to be more locally self-sufficient. Joining me today will be Professor Gar Oprovitz. He is the Lionel Bauman Professor of Political Economy at the University of Maryland and the founder of the Democracy Collaborative. He is a former fellow of politics at Harvard and Cambridge Universities and has served as a legislative director for the House of Representatives, the U.S. Senate, and is a special assistant to the State Department. He has also published numerous articles in peer-reviewed journals and major media, such as the New York Times. His focus has been on political economics that deal with class struggle and the conflict between the government, economic policies, and democracy. His most recent book is What Then Must We Do? Straight Talk About the Next American Revolution, which has been praised by Richard Wolff and Daniel Ellsberg and Naomi Klein and others for offering bottom-up solutions for systemic economic change. His website is Gar, and I'll spell it ALPEROVITZ.com, as well as democracycollaborative.org. He will be joined by Sarah Van Gelder. She is in Seattle, Washington. Sarah is the co-founder and executive editor of Yes Magazine and YesMagazine.org, one of the few remaining progressive publications challenging current dominant paradigms and offering feature-powerful ideas and practical solutions for building a more just and sustainable world. The magazine, which was founded in 1996, recently won the Utney Reader Media Award for General Excellence. She also sits on the board of the Positive Future Network and has founded and co-founded local community projects for low-income house developments and building cooperative operations and ventures linking organic farmers to urban markets. She is the lead author of This Changes Everything, Occupy Wall Street and the 99% Movement. The website is yesmagazine.org. I welcome both of you to our program.
Glad to be here. Thanks, Gary.
Thank you.
As many in the audience know who listen regularly, I give an extended introduction to show the overall view that we're trying to establish. Then I sit back and treat this more like a classroom on the air where our guests will have unlimited amounts of time, unrushed, so that they can lay out their insights. And with that, I'm going to begin with you, Gar, if you would, please. Since the implementation of Friedman's free market system in our political body, particularly during the Reagan years, followed by the later breakup of the Glass-Steagall Act, the present capitalist ideology has very little success to show for it, aside from further solidifying a plutocracy in this nation and widening the inequality gap, not just in the U.S., but globally as well. And yet we are constantly told that it only requires time for the free market system to prove itself. Anyone who has ever listened to Sean Hannity or Mark Levin or the leading pundits from the right, you hear them say over and over again, let the market correct the problem. Let the market guide us, as if these people have no sense of history or irony. And yet, when you look at individuals who have led that free market system, such as Lloyd Bankfein at Goldman Sachs, and they tell us that financial systems may have led us into the crisis, but it will lead us out. And another one of the best and brightest at Goldman's, Brian Griffiths, has said, we have to tolerate the inequality as a way to achieve greater prosperity and opportunity for all. In the meantime, since there is no historical precedent to give us hope that the Goldman boys could be right, we are stuck with only an unapproved economic theory, in my opinion. Therefore, these statements appear irrational and to many nonsensical, because we should be questioning whether these individuals should be leading one of the world's wealthiest financial institutions in advising our government. After all, there has been dozens of meetings between the leaders at Goldman Sachs, the President of the United States before he became president, and after he became president. But then we have to look at the results. Where are we today? We don't have a single economy. We have multiple economies, and different people are affected in unique ways. And yet, by watching the mainstream media, you would think because we've just broken a new record on Wall Street that things are just rebounding nicely all the way around. I challenge that. I've been on the road now for more than 3 months interviewing hundreds of Americans who once had some sense of prosperity, a quality of life, and today are eating cat food, today are living in their cars, or have been in shelters, or couch surfing, and have no hope. I'm not referring to a few people. I'm referring to more than 110 million people, one-third of the entire American population. And yet, when was the last time in any major media, on the Sunday morning talk shows, with supposedly the best and brightest, when did we hear their plight brought before our eyes? When did we see what it was like to be a person who was an engineer at Cape Canaveral that I interviewed in front of his car in Titusville, Florida, where he and four members of his family were heating a can of noodles on the radiator? His wife was an engineer. He was an engineer. They both have master's degree. And yet because they believe completely in the free market system and their government, they never thought that they would both be downsized. They would both end up having to spend their life savings and be homeless. And every time they've sought a job, they could not find one, except he did find a job finally drying cars at a car wash in Orlando. She finally found a job cleaning rooms for the day. They gave him enough money to buy food or sometimes have a hotel for a night. Why don't we ever hear of those individuals? Why don't we hear of 14 million senior citizens that no one is speaking for? They're invisible. You would think that they're all happy someplace living in a gated community. They are not. So what we have with us today is we've had the Blankfein and the Griffiths pointing us to a dominant system that has now become institutionalized in our domestic vocabulary, our economy, and it exerts greater power and influence over our legislature than anything else. It's not simply bad policies. Rather, it's bad policies grounded in a priori on very bad ideas and beliefs. So, please define for us the present economic paradigm that dominates our political discourse, and in what ways has it become systematic and not solely a matter of political incompetence? And then, please, look at billionaire Kenneth Griffin, one of the nation's wealthiest hedge fund managers. He has said, quote, "Wealthy have insufficient influence." Really? You could have fooled me. These are people who firmly believe that our political system would be better run by Wall Street and corporate executives, not public servants. The Koch brothers would certainly agree with this. So I'd like you also to share a critique of this continuing influence of private interest upon our public system. The forum is yours.
Well, thanks, Yuri. You've raised central questions that we all need to face, and I would also add some of the ecological issues that are now really becoming dire, particularly the climate change issues. But let me start with what you've raised. It's clear that we live in a system that is dominated by large corporations and the owners of the large corporations. It's no secret. One of the ways which the system is called corporate capitalism. That is what it is because the dominant institutions are very large and the ownership is very concentrated. But let me sharpen that. Just how concentrated the ownership and power structure is. It's not just individuals, but the latest data suggests that 400 people, this is a startling number to just get your mind around, 400 individuals, you could easily get them in one large airplane, have more wealth in the United States today than the bottom 180 million people taken together. Now, that is a literally medieval structure of ownership and power. I say that, and I need to correct myself immediately, because in a recent lecture I gave, a medieval historian came up to me afterward, and he said, power was never that concentrated in the medieval era. Wealth was concentrated, but not to that degree that we now face. And so it's startling for people to realize just how powerful the system is. Most people understand that there's great power, but it is an extreme form of corporate concentration and wealth ownership. And not surprisingly, along with that comes domination of the political system. And we know that, we feel it, but also academic studies demonstrate that time and again, that the power is there. What is new about the modern era, and I'd say the last 35 years, is for a while, particularly in the post-war period, the three decades after World War II, maybe up till about 1970, if you want a marker, there was sufficient, what John Kenneth Galbraith, the great economist, called countervailing power to sort of constrain the system, to keep it in line, to pass Medicare, to pass Medicaid, to do the great environmental regulations of the 60s and 70s, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, et cetera. For a while, taxation of the corporations and of the wealthy. At one point, individuals were taxed, even in the Eisenhower era, at 91% marginal rate, taxing the very wealthy. It's down now, has gone down steadily from 91 to 70 to 60 to 50, and now in the 35 to 38 range, and steadily going down, which is a good measure of the power that has changed. A corporate share of taxes has gone down from about 7 to 8% of GDP, now down in the 2% range over that period. So you can get trends that tell you how much has changed. At the core of that old system, and I was working in the House and Senate at the heyday of the system of countervailing power that sort of kept things in line, at the heart of that was the traditional labor union. And in America, 35% of the labor force were members of unions. And that was a powerful, not just on the shop floor, but it gave muscle to a progressive politics to stabilize, to keep in line, and to manage the economy with a more progressive way. What really has changed in our overall corporate-dominated economic system is that labor unions have collapsed. They're down. They were 35% of the labor force were in unions. It's now down to roughly 11% overall, only 6% in the private sector, and declining further. So what you're facing is the collapse of a balancing system in the corporate organized economy and in corporate organized politics. And the trends reflect the change in the power relationships of that old system. And it is a systemic crisis. When you see corporate taxes going down steadily, when you see income concentration going up steadily for 30 years. So for instance, the top 1% over the last 30 years has increased its income share from 10% to roughly 20 or 21%, depending upon the year you look at, which means the bottom 99% over three decades has lost that income. So virtually everywhere you look, for instance, in terms of CO2 production, has gone up 30% since the 1970s. One other element that gives you a sense of the systemic nature, that is the long, long trends, no matter who gets elected, president or Congress, these are the trends that go on and tells you something deeper is going on. So, for instance, take the question of liberty, the most important element of American kind of ideology and vision. Well, the real test of liberty is who gets to put who loses liberty. We've just seen what's happened when certain in the Trevin case that of the assassination would be another way to put it, that just happened in Florida. There somebody did not lose their liberty, but if you look at who loses their liberty, who gets put in prison over time, you'll see that over the last 30 years, roughly, the number has gone from about 85 per 100,000 go to prison to something like 750 per 100,000. The trend, again, telling you something deeper is at work. We now put more people in prison losing liberty than any of the advanced systems, eight times as many, including Russia. So something very profound is going on in the system itself, no matter who's elected. And at the core of that really is all systems, who gets to own the wealth is dominant in politics in virtually all systems. The corporate system we've just talked about, the very wealthy and the corporations dominate because they control the wealth. In state socialism, it was the state, and it dominated and controlled the wealth. In medieval times, it was the lords and king and the church controlling land, which was the source of wealth, and they dominated the system. Well, we're in a system where either we're going to build up another form of who gets to own and control and dominate wealth, or the corporate system will continue to the trends that we're already seeing. What is exciting is that at the grassroots level, we're seeing the buildup of what I call democratizing wealth organizations, building up and changing ownership step by step all over the country in areas that the people don't really read about because the press doesn't cover it. I've tried to report on this in my book, What Then Must We Do, and Yes Magazine, which my friend Sarah edits, covers it regularly. But you don't find it in the major newspapers, and you don't find it in the television, and you don't find it much in radio programs, except programs of your kind and the network we're on today. But for instance, there are already 130 million Americans who are members of co-ops in one form or another in the United States. Now, that's important because a co-op, traditional co-op, and there are many kinds, some better, some worse, is simply democratic ownership of wealth in one form or another. A worker-owned company is one co-op. There are cooperative-owned banks. They're called credit unions. People know about them as credit unions. And within the credit union movement, there is a move to make them much more interesting and more democratized. They are one-person, one-vote banks. And they could be doing very creative things, and in some parts of the country they are. If you take the credit unions together, by the way, all of them together have more capital than most of the New York big banks. So there's an extreme concentration of potential power that is democratically owned. We're seeing buildups. For instance, there's interest in state-owned banks, like the Bank of North Dakota, which is a public bank rather than a Wall Street bank or a private bank. Changing the basis of the system step by step, looking at who gets to control wealth, is a critical change in the basic underlying institutions of the society. There are many other examples of this at the city level, for instance. Who controls land is a critical issue. And land development has been the big realtors and investment people. But in many, many cities now, we're getting nonprofit or city-owned land development. It's called a land trust, where you build up ownership of land and capture the profits by democratizing that ownership. That used to be a very radical idea. Now there are hundreds of them popping up. And I could go on, and indeed, as I said, I describe a lot of this in the book, What Then Must We Do, because it gives people something to see that is actually happening in many, many parts of the country, and much of it ecologically very interesting as well. Some very interesting examples that can be done in virtually any community. A lot of it's being driven simply by the failure of the ongoing system. The current corporate system is creating pain as well as trends of the kind we're talking about. And the old alternatives, electing a liberal congressman or senator, the kind I used to work for years ago, you can elect folks, but the trends continue. So either we build up something new and fresh from the bottom and begin slowly, and the way to think about this is, you know, in the decades before the New Deal, in the 2 to 3 decades before, the experimentation was happening in the so-called state and local laboratories of democracy. Small-scale things building up in the state of Wisconsin, where I'm from, for instance, in labor law, and you found pension development became the basis of Social Security. This experimentation at the right moment became the basis of national programs and the whole vision of where we might go. And I think something similar is now happening, which could be the basis of the next great transformation, building up step by step in many parts of the country and beginning to educate people, beginning to give people a sense of what you can do, starting where you are, building from the bottom, beginning to develop, but also a vision of a society that moves beyond the corporate system, ultimately, and beyond the state socialist system, a society which takes and values community first, but democratizes ownership and changes the power that goes along with ownership, does it in many different ways. I call it a pluralist, many different forms of ownership, whether co-ops or land trusts or some city ownership, state banks, plural forms of ownership, or what I call a pluralist commonwealth, building up a direction that both builds from community, but it also integrates ecological values and concerns as well. Let me give you a really interesting example and something about the process as well, just in two different areas. I happened to work with the steelworkers in Youngstown, Ohio, in the 1970s, when one of the biggest kind of cutdowns and collapses of a major firm, Youngstown Sheet and Tube, occurred. 5,000 people lost their job one day in 1977. And that was big news in 1977. It hadn't happened much in the United States up till that point. But when it happened, the religious leaders and the steelworkers decided, why can't we set up a worker community-owned mill jointly, community and worker ownership? And I was called in to help with a number of other people. And they put forward, they got the Carter administration at that time to help finance a very sophisticated study and of how to do it. And indeed, it was a viable business proposition, would have been a very interesting model. And then they did their politics well. They built pressure in the state of Ohio. They built pressure in the religious community. They educated the public. And they got the Carter administration to promise $200 million in loan guarantees to finance a worker community-owned large mill. Well, not surprisingly, after the election of 1978, things changed. The steel companies and the International Labor Union, Steelworkers Union, seemed to have gotten their way, and the money disappeared. But these folks were very sophisticated, and there's a lesson in it for people now who want to think about the long haul. They continued the effort to educate people about a different vision, about, in this case, worker community ownership or worker-owned companies or cooperatives, and began building power and ideas so that over many years in the state of Ohio, and many other states are beginning to look like this, there are more worker-owned companies per capita probably than any place because there's been a buildup in many, many parts of the city and the state. And there has also been innovation, and that's where it gets even more interesting. So in the city of Cleveland, where some of our people have been working, there is a very interesting complex of worker-owned cooperatives linked together with a revolving fund so that they help finance production of new cooperatives. And also, part of the money goes into a fund that's a nonprofit corporation to help finance the city, the city area, the neighborhood that we're in. It's a very poor neighborhood, black neighborhood, 40% unemployment, about 40,000 people. So this complex grew out of the long developmental trend, step by step, and is now an innovative change in addition to the old co-op models. It's a complex community building model, partly drawing on the Mondragon example from the Basque country of Spain, a great cooperative model. But then there's a further innovation, and what's important about this is it can be done in any city around the country, and indeed is being done. In the middle of this very poor neighborhood, there are major institutions, the universities and hospitals. Case Western Reserve is there, the University Hospital, and the Cleveland Clinic, the very famous, kind of world-famous Cleveland Clinic. Those are nonprofit corporations with a lot of taxpayer money in them, Medicare, Medicaid, educational programs, student loans, et cetera, and student grants and research grants, most of which is being used for other purposes. Those three institutions I mentioned in this very poor neighborhood of about 40,000 people, and again, think of your own city as you hear about this, they purchase about $3 billion, with a B, dollars in goods and services a year, just those three institutions. None of it from this neighborhood. Now, that's in addition to the salaries and in addition to the construction, just what they buy. So partly what's happened is that there's been an effort to convince these big, big nonprofits with a lot of taxpayer money in them to begin focusing on rebuilding the neighborhood by buying from the complex of worker-owned companies. So there's a whole model of development that takes us beyond just worker companies and co-ops floating in an uncertain capitalist market. There's an attempt to stabilize the community and rebuild that way. Now, it's a very interesting model in that respect. But what is even more significant about it is that as the pain levels around the country elsewhere are growing, People are moving much faster than the Ohio story, which is a 30-year story. They're beginning to see things like what I've just described in the Cleveland model, it's called. And many, many cities are now taking up that model. And the question is, why is this being done? Why are there a number of, I was just down in Atlanta, Atlanta's doing this, Pittsburgh's doing something similar, three in the Washington, D.C. area, one in Amarillo, Texas, one in Richmond, California. Many, many cities are moving in this direction and exploring it. Some hundred cities have begun explorations. Why is that happening? And why are all the co-op and worker-owned companies appearing, like New Era Windows in Chicago? Why is this happening? It's happening because the growing crisis of the system is closed out the old options, and people are being forced to develop their own, get it done now, build a new model, begin to move forward in new political ways, because if you don't, the pain will continue. And that's a driving force in a particular way in a historic era. It's the partly it's very optimistic, partly it's coming out of pain, but really more important analytically is people need to think, and I try to write about this again in What Then Must We Do. If you begin to stand back and see that these aren't simply projects that are good things to do, they are projects that are good things to do, and there are many, many more out there, thousands of them. If you begin to see them, that they are developing because the context of the failing system is forcing people to reassess and rethink and begin to realize either we build a new direction or the pain continues, then you begin to see that there's reason to hope and believe that not only are good ideas important, but that there are historic forces that are giving people a sense that it's time to begin moving in a more powerful, organized, directed sense of where we want to go. And I think that's what's critical about this moment.
Gar, let me interject a few things, and thank you for that in-depth analysis. I'm going to throw several points that don't require a lot of explanation, but at least I'd like to show how your comments have to be at the backdrop of the powerful people who control the purse strings of the government, even at the state level. And I'm going to bring each one of them in separately. This is a letter that was sent to Ben Bernanke from five congresspersons. It's short, but it brings a whole new dynamic into our discussion. Dear Chairman Bernanke, we write in regards to the expansion of large banks into what had traditionally been non-financial commercial spheres. Specifically, we're concerned about how large banks have recently expanded their businesses into such fields as electric power production, oil refining and distribution, owning and operating public assets such as ports and airports, and even uranium mining. Here are a few examples. Morgan Stanley imported 4 million barrels of oil and petroleum products into the United States this year. Goldman Sachs stores aluminum in vast warehouses in Detroit, as well as serving as a commodities derivative dealer. This so-called bank is also expanding into the ownership and operation of airports, toll roads, and ports. J.P. Morgan markets electricity in California. In other words, Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan, and Morgan Stanley are no longer just banks. They've effectively become oil companies, port and airport operators, commodities dealers, and electric utilities as well. This is causing unforeseen problems for the industrial sector of the economy. For example, Coca-Cola has filed a complaint with the London Metal Exchange that Goldman Sachs was hoarding aluminum. J.P. Morgan is currently being probed by regulators for manipulating power prices in California, where the bank was marketing electricity from power plants and controls. We don't know what other price manipulations could be occurring due to potential informational advantages accruing to derivative dealers who also market and sell commodities. The long shadow of Enron could loom in these activities. And then it goes on to talk about how many major industries, the banks, are now in possession of that no one knew of. Now, I have to attach that to this for to ground this in some meaningful way. Historically in the United States, if you were a small or large business operator and you had problems, either of your own design or some circumstance intervened, and you had to close your business, you went through a structured bankruptcy. The stockholders took the loss. You generally reorganized and came out of it clean and started over in many cases. However, since the debacle of the collapse, every one of the 22 largest financial institutions in the United States, and also hedge funds, also foreign banks, equity partnerships, and other corporations, including Verizon, were able, through secret, because it was only found out through Bernie Sanders, the independent from Vermont, and Ron Paul, who got an audit bill passed, that we found out that $16.1 trillion was given in 22,000 transactions to these people. We were not disclosed what they gave as collateral. We know they paid zero interest for it. And then they immediately turned around and started creating more debt with derivatives, buying up their competition. None of it, not a penny of that, went to small businesses to stop homes from being foreclosed on, to help with infrastructure. It all went for self-serving purposes, making money off money, creating massive debt. Just four of those banks are holding $166 trillion in derivative positions, of which the United States government is backing it up. So if they fail on any level, the entire economy could be collapsed. And yet they're not held accountable. Now, I decided to do some homework on this. And this came from some work I did a few years ago when I was challenging the power of the pharmaceutical industry and how many of the drugs they create cause death, and yet they've not been held accountable. No one's gone to jail. 65,000 Americans died from one drug called Vioxx, and yet they paid a $5.45 billion fine, and their stock went up, and the head of the company got a raise. And I'm thinking to myself, where else except in America could you kill 65,000 people with malice aforethought, because one of the whistleblowers that testified before Congress that I filmed, a Dr. Graham, had known about the dangers, warned the people at the FDA that it was a dangerous drug that would increase heart attack and stroke, and he was relegated to oblivion. And then they went ahead and, in 4 years, a minimum of 65,000 deaths and more than 120,000 injured who survived. And yet, when I dug into their background, they had over 100,000 lawsuits. Everyone on Wall Street, every single firm, every single bank has settled criminal and civil violation lawsuits, paying nearly $500 billion in fines over the last 30 years. There's not a single one that did not have multiple crimes that they were convicted of. Yet no one went to jail. They continue to prosper. And then when it comes time for us to rectify these too big to fails, these corrupt enterprises, instead, we penalize the American public by creating a form of austerity, by cutting back on Medicare and social programs and school programs and food programs with 18 million hungry children every day in the United States, 1.5 million children who leave school each day and have no home to go to, they're the largest number of homeless children in a developed world in the world, and yet we won't give a penny to them, but we continue to give them quantitative easings above and beyond the $16 trillion they got. So our figures have to be correct. It's up to $22 trillion. These same people continue to get, and yet they're a series of criminal acts, and they're never held accountable. If they fail, they're never held accountable. If they never have to declare bankruptcy, but you and I are held to a different set of rules. If one of their banks this year had to pay an $850 billion fine, they made a million fine. They had over $800 billion in money laundering. It was proven by the Justice Department that they were laundering money for organized crime and drug cartels. And yet if you and I in New York City, if we're stopped and searched, mainly people of color, are stops and search, 92% are stops and search, who are stopped. If you are told, empty your pockets, where it is not a crime to have a small amount of marijuana in your pocket, the moment you show that marijuana, you'll be arrested and can go to jail for 7 or more years. So I'm looking at this and I'm saying we have serial offenders of civil and criminal actions who are rewarded, never punished. If you and I, like Martha Stewart, go to prison for not insider trader, but lying about it, she is forever monikered as a former convict. Yet they are never monikered. They continue to have this absolute control. And now they've gone from the banking and the derivative market and credit default swaps and all the bunching of mortgages. Now they're going into owning public services, airports, ports. They are partnering across the world, and we're waking up one day, and the very people who are the most immoral at and least capable of running a business are running everything, because on a real standard, if you, as a professor and a highly respected one, if you taught your students to hire people who had repeatedly failed, had lied, had manipulated, had insider traded, had price gouged and price forged, you would be challenged as an ethical teacher. And yet this is what we have in our society. So here a group of senators have written the head of the Federal Reserve and saying, you're funding them. Why aren't you doing anything? Now, my last point, which is essential to this, is I believe, as some others do, that we are approaching the day in the very near future where the dollar will no longer be used as the reserve currency. And when that day happens, I have to ask, what will be the likely outcome of a currency collapse? What will it look like? How will it impact us? And until we understand that since the last 100 years, you can only buy 3 cents against a dollar compared to 100 years ago, that means that 97% of the value of our currency has gone into the pocket of the Federal Reserve. And I'm amazed that this is never discussed, and the actual complicity of the private banks working with the Federal Reserve and the control they have over everything from fractional reserve banking. And what are they going to do? What are they going to do when China, India, Japan, Australia, and Russia have already signed agreements, their own trade agreements, where the currencies of choice will no longer contain the dollar? 23 Central and South American countries have stated the same. So the day will come when the dollar is no longer the reserve currency. Not a word spoken anywhere in the United States in the media of what the concept of not just inflation, but possibly hyperinflation. And I might remind us, we did have a Weimar Germany from 1922 to 23, where prices doubled every 3 days. In modern era Yugoslavia from 1992 to 1994, witnessed prices doubling every 34 hours. And least us forget is Zimbabwe, 2 year period from 2007 to 2008, prices doubled every 25 hours. I'm not suggesting that. I am suggesting that we are unprepared completely for a currency collapse, which is possible. Your thoughts on these subjects, please.
Well, first, I'm glad you raised these major questions, particularly in the banking industry. You might add further that the banks are more concentrated now than they were before the crisis. They have gobbled up a bigger share of the economy than they had before the crisis. I think what you're talking about here is there's two parts that are important to emphasize. They are beginning, I think, to pave the way for growing anger, both on the left and on the right. Virtually every major expert that I read, left, right, and center, conservatives as well, predict a major financial crisis, just as you have in another way, that the capacity of the government to regulate these giant corporations is just about nil in terms of the really major issues. There are loopholes in the current law, Dodd-Frank law. There's loopholes throughout the system. And furthermore, there's no intent to regulate. The Attorney General of the United States, and this gives you a sense of the corporate-dominated system we've been talking about, the Attorney General of the United States testified before Congress recently when asked about why there were no prosecutions of any of the bankers. Why is this so? There are so many instances that you could go and find illustrations of the kind you're talking about. And he said, which you might expect him to say, well, there's no evidence, so we can't do it. What he said, in fact, was, these banks are so important to the economy, I can't really risk that. Now, just think about what that says. The chief legal officer of the United States, looking at these large corporate banks, says they can create any crime they like. I can't attack them because it'll create a financial crisis. I'm exaggerating slightly, but only slightly. His testimony basically said roughly the same thing. Well, there are many, many elements of what you've described, and we're talking about the banking system now, that are further demonstration of both the power of the current system, but also the difficulties it's creating. And I want to emphasize that there's growing awareness of the difficulties, and there's growing interest in alternative solutions. Now, I wear a hat as a political economist and a historian. So when I see these kinds of dynamics, the interesting thing to me is how over time people become more and more aware, and they are more aware. 35 years ago, and here's another trend that tells you something, the poll data would suggest if you ask people Do you believe in the democratic system? Do you believe in what's happening? What is your view of what's going on in Washington? The 3 out of 4, usually, sometimes 2/3, but usually 3 out of 4 would say, well, I elect my congressman. He does what the people want, and he goes to Washington, and the government does what the people want. That's basically what the Gallup poll said 35 years ago. There's been a change in awareness. People are no longer quite so taken in by things. Over the last 30 years, and this is important because it tells you long trends of how people begin to shift consciousness and then maybe begin to take action, begin to take much more active forms. 35 years now people, if you ask the same question, they say, well, people in Washington are run by the big banks and the big corporations and by money. Everyone knows that they do that. They don't represent the people anymore. By and large, that's what the poll data says. And the importance is that the public is no longer fooled. That doesn't mean we're ready at the stage where people are ready to take major action, but it means that we're preparing the groundwork for something very different because they don't believe the old stuff anymore in large numbers. And that is the precondition of much, much more active politics and protest and the beginnings of an era like the great progressive era, the explosions that will come. And that's where the hope lies coming out of the painful things you're talking about and out of all of the experimentation that's happening. So if you view it in longer-term perspective, exactly what you're talking about, the major trends and the growing pain and the unemployment and the poverty and the ecological destruction, which we haven't talked about, global warming, and the disruption of communities, that's the backdrop that's deepening the pain and deepening awareness. The hopeful side is, and this is the side that the press doesn't cover, is there are more and more developments. Yes Magazine really covers a lot of this as well, and as I said in my book, What Then Must We Do, the things that are coming up primarily because people are aware something new must be done, something with a different vision, but also something that takes over and democratizes ownership so that we don't end up with the top tiny groups holding virtually all the wealth in the system of importance.
I appreciate those insights. Let's go over now and say hello to Sarah. Sarah, thank you for your patience and standing by to be on with us today.
Oh, no problem. I always enjoy hearing what Gar has to say.
Now, you've heard what he has had to say describing the present systemic challenge facing citizens and its threat to citizen democracy. And you and your colleagues at Yes Magazine, such as David Corton, and many grassroots organizations, thought leaders dedicated to building sustainable structures that he's talking about and finding innovative solutions at the local and community and regional levels, have observed intimately the impact of the present economic and political system that is has on communities and people's lives. And the fact of the matter is that the foreclosures continue. Water is being privatized that will raise utility costs. There remains the corporate push to privatize schools, which in terms of cost can never compete with the public school system. And just about everywhere our environment is toxic, whether it's due to pesticide runoff, hydrofracking, chemical dumping, fallout from heavy metals, from geoengineering, or coal power plants, which Obama now wants to increase their number. And in large part, this is due to weak regulation of these industries. And poverty has not abated, but is rather increasing. An independent analysis show that unemployment rates are either stagnant or simply flawed, and the actual rate is about 22% when you take what people are actually doing. When they drop out of the effort to seek jobs, they're no longer considered unemployed. We aired a special broadcast a couple months ago with Margaret Flowers and an economist at the University of Massachusetts who performed the independent individual state financial analysis of Obamacare for the Physicians for a National Health Plan. And aside of providing coverage to the poorest of Americans, its long-term impact on middle-class citizens and small business will be disastrous. And all these issues are directly related to the power and influence of the corporate hold over the political body. And the list goes on. So, from the vantage point of individuals and local communities, please describe for us how they perceive the power of the current economic system. And from their vantage point, what should we define as an equitable democratic model that empowers individuals to have a voice and stand up against power and wealth, but also create a new alternative set of intrinsically democratic positions for our communities?
Well, that's a pretty big question, Gary. And thank you so much for having me on. You know, what we do at Yes Magazine is we don't believe that we have the answers. We don't actually believe that any one person or one organization has all the answers. What we think is that there are thousands, maybe millions of people out in the, all over the United States, all over the world, who are developing the answers. And what our job is as journalists is to go find those people, find out what they're doing, and find out why they're doing it, and then talk to people like Gar, who are the visionaries who can sort of weave it all together into one big picture of what a different world might look like. But what's so exciting to me right now is that a lot of those alternatives are coming from the grassroots up. A lot of there's a great deal of diversity among them. I think Gar might have mentioned that these are issues that are not just ones that are on one side of the political spectrum. There's a lot of people who are discontent with the combination of Wall Street and the U.S. government and how the two are operating together to have so much influence over our lives. Some people, maybe on the Tea Party side, emphasize the problems with government more. Some people on the left might emphasize the problem with corporations more. But there's a great deal of discontent, and there's a great deal of openness and excitement about building the alternatives at the grassroots level. So that's what we do at Yes Magazine. We do article after article every day. We're posting online at yesmagazine.org with stories of what people are doing, and every quarterly issue of the magazine is about a different aspect of how people are creating this kind of a different world.
Well, let's take one point then that you've done.
Sure. Yeah, well, one of the topics I'm especially interested in right now is food. We've done a couple of issues on food. We do it as an ongoing kind of coverage, and we're also working on a theme for the winter that will be on food. And the wonderful thing about food is that when people think about the future, and they think about how uncertain things are, and how, you know, the various kinds of collapses that you talked about, the kind of collapse that I'm most concerned about is the ecological collapse and the possibility that climate change could really, you know, upend our ability to grow food in the industrial way that has been supplying food, and could really reduce the amount of fresh water that's available for supporting the way that we've been living up till now. So given that when people think about uncertainty in the future, they almost always think first about, well, how am I going to eat? Where is food going to come from? And I think that's one of the reasons there's a great deal of energy behind the local food movement now. You know, in just about every community, there's a farmer's market, or there's a local farm that has a community-supported agriculture, and they're bringing food into people who are, you know, who are in a direct relationship with them as farmers. There's food co-ops. As Gar mentioned, there's land trusts, and people are figuring out how do we get control of some land so we can make sure that farmers, including these young people who are just starting up, how can we make sure that they have an opportunity to grow food for our community? So then all the way up throughout the food system, people are working on this question. How do we not only grow food locally, but how do we get it to our local hospitals and our local schools and universities? And there's a place where that project that Gar was talking about in Cleveland is so interesting, where the cooperative there has actually built a mammoth greenhouse so that they can grow greens year-round and supply people in the hospital and in the schools with healthy, organic, locally grown food, just not instead of food that's coming from thousands of miles away. We're going to be doing a story about Portland, where they're bringing back something that many of us on the West Coast miss, which is the food cart. You know, and food carts are a great way for immigrants, people who are new to this country, to get a foothold in the local economy, because they bring this wonderful tradition of their food culture and how to cook it, and they can bring it into the city, and they can create these wonderful conversational pedestrian spaces where people can gather, they can get to know each other, they can overcome the prejudices they might have about people who are immigrants or who speak a different language or live differently than themselves. So food is this wonderful way that we connect with one another, and we build a stronger sense of community and stronger sense of mutual respect. So there's so many different ways that food is coming into play, and that people are really questioning whether industrial agriculture is a way that can provide us with a healthy way of life. I mean, you mentioned the pesticide runoff. There's also tremendous concern about the amount of GMO, amount that our food is now genetically modified, and so that massive amounts of pesticides, more than was used in the past, is now being used on food that's been genetically modified to make it so that it won't be killed by the amount of pesticides put on it. But there's some real questions about whether that's healthy for you and me. There's real questions about whether our government should be subsidizing the least healthy kinds of foods through the massive farm bill and the agricultural subsidies, instead of subsidizing the locally grown fruits and vegetables that really every health professional tells us are far better for us. So there's lots of different ways.
I have a follow-up question for you then.
Sure.
Gar has mentioned about four times, and rightly so, that we have a major problem with global warming that we're not honest about. And that's because of the financial impact it would have on certain industries if they actually had to take some of their excessive profits and put it back into either a living wage for their workers, their local community, or clean up the mess they're making. So there's a consensus that the economic impact due to climate change will be immense and will affect local sources, food, utilities, quality of health. What some environmentalists are urging is the need for people to learn to reorient their way of livelihood to adapt to the climate changes and the impact it had. So can you speak on that and the practical ways people can reorient to their local environmental condition? And what programs are there that people can look into that will aid them in this endeavor as well?
Yeah, that's a huge question. I mean, you know, if you look at what happened in New York after Hurricane Sandy, the costs are already being felt. People are already paying massive amounts for all the carbon we've been putting up into the atmosphere and the major storms that are an outcome of this kind of climate change. And if you look at the droughts in the Midwest and all the crops that were lost there, if you look at the huge wildfires in Colorado, which are more likely in a time when the rainfall doesn't come because the jet stream has been disrupted by a changing climate, you know, the costs are everywhere across the board. So I think we can't afford to ignore that we need to do two things. We need to be doing everything we can to prevent more of this disruption to our atmosphere and to our climate. We can't afford to go over 3, 4, 5 degrees centigrade increase by the end of the century, and that means making big changes now in terms of how much fossil fuels we use. So that's one thing. And the other is the question that you asked is about how do we prepare in our own communities to adapt to the rising sea levels and the changing weather patterns and so forth. And, you know, I don't think there's any one-size-fits-all solution because every community is going to be affected in a different way. But I would say that for communities to really look carefully at the question of resilience, what does it take for our community to be prepared to have a diverse set of sources of water, to have diverse ways of getting our food, to know each other well so that we can come together in a crisis, in a bad weather situation, or, you know, a tornado, or we can come together in a flood and help each other out. So building those kinds of local forms of resilience where people learn how to get to know each other and how to get along, because the truth is that our government is not going to come and save us. I mean, we saw that in Katrina, and we saw that to some degree in New York, although they did much better in New York and New Jersey. We've just got to learn to do those things ourselves, and I think that's also where you get to a lot of the interest in local foods, because the more that we have local food supplies and a diverse set of different foodstuffs that can supply us, the less reliant we are on the one or two or three major commodity crops that can fail when you have these big droughts in the Midwest.
You're absolutely correct. In fact, what people are not aware of is that the Arctic is very shallow, many places just 500 feet. And across the entire Arctic and then going across the Russian tundra, you have the largest amount of captured carbon in the world and methane. And from the Industrial Revolution around the 1840s and 50s till today, we've released about 300 billion tons of that gas. What is stored in the Arctic area and across Russia in the permafrost, keeping it in, is 2 trillion. So imagine what's going to happen now that it's melting. Now they're finding thousands and thousands of bubble chimneys coming up, releasing methane, which is a greater contributor than just carbon dioxide, to global warming. You also have greater melt-off on mountains, which then doesn't allow reflection back into the atmosphere, hence heating up. So the water expands when heated. We're going to have a greater rate of water increase, especially from Greenland and Antarctica. And yet, all across the world, we are the least prepared, with over 56 million people in the United States living within 50 miles of the ocean, of doing anything to stop these surges, to stop the high category storms that are inevitable. And as you saw, I live in New York City. I had my station prepared. I had water and everything. And our sister station, WBAI, refused to acknowledge that it could get bad. 3 hours later, after I told them to come up, bring their engineers, and they could use our studio at the Progressive Radio Network, they went off the air. They looked outside. They couldn't leave the building. The water from Hurricane Sandy down on Wall Street was 2 feet above the street light. 2 feet above it. The whole bottom floors were flooded. No one predicted it. No one believed it possible. And it's now up to $75 billion. And that was only a Category 1. Way do you think? Way do you see the big ones? So we need to be prepared. We need to become aware. We need to get out of our comfort zone. We need to get out of the state of mind that somehow we're going to be rescued by the federal, state, or local governments. By the way, the government was so ill-prepared through FEMA. They had no gasoline, no bottled water, no portable generators, all of which they had. They had 200 portable generators to keep a hospital going. None of that existed. As a result, in all of Lower Manhattan, you couldn't get any water and electricity, food, nothing. So I'm concerned that we, who choose to be alive and well and focused, pay attention to the advice that you and Gar have given. I thank you both. We're out of time. You've given us a lot to think about, and I certainly appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Gary.
Yeah, thank you, Gary and Sarah.
I'm Gary Knoll. I want to thank you for listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour. You've been listening just now to Sarah Van Gelder from Seattle, Washington, from yesmagazine.org. That's the website. And also from Maryland, Professor Gar Alperovitz. He is the Lionel Bauman Professor of Political and Economy at the University of Maryland and the founder of the Democracy Collaborative. He is a former fellow of politics at Harvard and Cambridge University, and he is also the author of What Then Must We Do? Straight Talk About the Next American Revolution. And his website is democracycollaborative.org or garalperovitz.com. Thank you for listening. I look forward to sharing more on our next program.